Would you please turn to the book of Genesis chapter 22? Genesis chapter 22. And while we're turning to it, just a brief word of introduction. I want to speak today about the providence of God. And then tonight I will be talking about the silence of God. Now subjects like the providence of God and the silence of God are of significant interest to all Christians because they are among the great mysteries of life. And when we talk about the silence of God, as we shall do tonight, we will be talking about the apparent absence of God's direct interference in human affairs. But when we talk about the providence of God, we're talking about God's foresight and about God taking the necessary steps to provide against a foreseen emergency, which is exactly what we will see happening as we read Genesis 22. Now, it's very important indeed, that we occasionally look at the greatness of God and that we see, in fact, how God upholds, how He guides, how He governs all the events and circumstances of men as well as angels to their appointed goal for His own glory. You see, what we must understand is that because God is God, He doesn't wait upon man's will before He acts in the world. Sometimes He does, but He need not do it because He is sovereign. And while most certainly God has given man a will of His own, which makes man morally responsible for the decisions he makes, yet we know that God is still in control. Something of which we need to remind ourselves. You see, brothers and sisters, we need to have this vision of the greatness of God more frequently than we do. And we need to get our eyes away from ourselves and realize that God is still in control. And even though at times we may think that Satan's in control, and even though at times we have to face problems which are hard to understand, our faith must remain in God. And so the providence of God is presented in the Bible as a function of divine sovereignty. It reveals that God is king, that God is over all, doing what He wills. And that means that like Job, we must bow in worship before Him, knowing that all things work together for good to them that love God. Now let's be more specific. Just how do we see the providence of God in control of the affairs of men and women? Well, let's read Genesis 22 and we'll read from verse 1. Genesis 22, verse 1. And it came to pass after these things that God did tempt Abraham and said unto him, Abraham, and he said, Behold, here I am. And he said, Take now thy son, thine only son Isaac, whom thou lovest, and get thee into the land of Moriah, and offer him there for a burnt offering upon one of the mountains which I will tell thee of. And Abraham rose up early in the morning, and saddled his ass, and took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and clave the wood for the burnt offering, and rose up and went unto the place of which God had told him. Then on the third day Abraham lifted up his eyes and saw the place afar off. And Abraham said unto his young men, Abide ye here with the ass, and I and the lad will go yonder and worship and come again to you. And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering and laid it upon Isaac his son, and he took the fire in his hand and a knife, and they went both of them together. And Isaac spake unto Abraham his father and said, My father, and he said, Here am I, my son. And he said, Behold the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for a burnt offering? And Abraham said, My son, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering. So they went both of them together. Now I want you to notice that, verse 8, where you see God providing against a foreseen emergency. God foresaw that Isaac would be in need of a substitute if his life was to be spared. So God took appropriate measures to provide that substitute. And so verse 13 tells us, "And Abraham lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him for a burnt offering in the stead of his son." You see, that ram was there by the providence of God. Now do you see what I mean? Now let's explain things in more detail. Because what I've done is start at the center of the circle. We want to work our way up to the circumference. But first let's go back to the beginning and view the providence of God in creation. We won't turn to it. But in Genesis chapters 1 and 2, we have the record of how God created the heavens and the earth. Now those chapters also record how God provided man with food and minerals and all the things necessary for man to live on the earth. And we know, although at times God executes judgment on the earth because of man's sin, those judgments are providentially controlled. And in the words of Nahum 1 verse 3, God has his way in the storm and in the whirlwind, and the clouds are the dust of his feet. In fact, Job 37 verse 13 tells us that God sends rain upon the earth, either for correction or for mercy, or to water the earth. And so there's the providential care of God in the creation around us. You see, the simple fact of the matter, and this is what I want to emphasize at the outset, is that all life on earth is dependent on the goodness of God. But then there's also the providence of God in the lives of people. So would you please turn to Genesis chapter 45. Genesis chapter 45, a chapter which records the life of Joseph. We won't read much of the chapter because we all know the story well. How in his early life, everything for Joseph seemed to go wrong. His brothers were jealous and told their father that Joseph was dead, when in fact they had made him a prisoner and sold him as a slave. And Joseph's misfortune didn't end there. Because when he arrived in Egypt from the home of Potiphar, he was thrown into prison. And everybody forgot about him. And his life was one disaster after another, but then Joseph's life took a turn for the better. And here in Genesis 45, Joseph, in his own words, is reviewing his life. So notice what he says. First, verse 5, where he's talking to his brothers. Rather, verse 4. "And Joseph said unto his brethren, Come near to me, I pray you. And they came near. And he said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom ye sold into Egypt. Now therefore, be not grieved nor angry with yourselves, that ye sold me hither. For God did send me before you to preserve life." I want you to notice those words. "God did send me before you to preserve life." Now verse 7. "And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity," or in other words, a remnant, "in the earth, and to save your lives by a great deliverance." Now verse 8. "So it was not you that sent me, but God." Verse 9. "Haste ye and go up to my father and say unto him, Thus says thy son Joseph, God hath made me Lord of all Egypt." Do you see now what I mean? From the position he was now in, Joseph saw the overruling, controlling, restraining and directing hand of God over his life. You see, God knew the famine was to occur, and God took steps to provide food for when the famine occurred. And what's more, God selected and fitted the very man who was needed to organize things and overcome the famine. You see, the jealousy of Joseph's brothers, the slavery, the prison, the lies told by Potiphar's wife could later be pieced together to form the complete design. And so what I'm saying is that divine providence always presupposes a purpose which cannot be frustrated by anything that man can do. And let's remember that. Now let's come back to Genesis 25. Genesis 25, where we see how the providence of God operates in families. And here in Genesis 25, we have, for an example, the family of Isaac and Rebekah. Now Isaac and Rebekah had two sons, Jacob and Esau, and we read in verse 27, "And the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents." Now we may ask, how could God providentially order the lives of two men who were so different? And that's hard to understand. But that's not the only difficulty. Look at the mistakes the parents made. Verse 28. "And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison, but Rebekah loved Jacob." Each of the parents showing favoritism. What an unhappy state of affairs. Now look at one of the sons in verse 32, Esau. And notice what a careless and easygoing attitude he had. "And Esau said, Behold, I am at the point to die, and what profit shall this birthright be to me?" Now over to chapter 27, where it seems that because of Isaac's old age and physical weakness, he'd lost control of his family. Verse 1, "And it came to pass that when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim, so that he could not see, he called Esau his eldest son, and said unto him, My son. And he said, Behold, here am I." And then in the verses that follow, we won't read them, there's the deception of both Jacob and his mother Rebekah. But what I really want you to notice is that in spite of all these circumstances, God was still controlling events according to his sovereign election and purpose, which he had stated earlier in chapter 25, "The elder shall serve the younger." You see, in spite of the family situation, so human and so true to life, God was still in control, and God's purpose was still being accomplished. And let's remember that the family life of God's people is still being controlled in precisely the same way today, something from which parents may take warning and also encouragement. But now let's look at the providence of God in the genealogy of our Lord. For instance, if we had time to examine the genealogy of Matthew, we'd see some very interesting things. For instance, in the tribe of Judah, there were included four Gentile women. Two from Canaan, Tamar and Rahab, one from Moab, who was Ruth, and one who was probably a Hittite, whose name was Bathsheba. Now the character of at least three of these women was not very good at all. But each of them was incorporated by the sovereignty of God into the Lord's genealogy. And so again, we see God's providence. God had a purpose in view. God was going to bring into the world his son. And this was accomplished in spite of the original character of some of these women. You see, God is over all. And despite the many attempts of Satan to frustrate the purpose of God, which was that the Messiah would come through the tribe of Judah, in spite of the unholy unions which took place, God still overruled so that his purpose would be accomplished. Then there's the providence of God in the affairs of a nation. And this can be seen in the book of Esther, which you may be interested to know, doesn't even mention once the name of God. But God's overruling control is what the book is all about. For it was only by the almighty power of God that could coordinate such a variety of events so that in the end, God's people were preserved. First, there was the disobedience of the queen. And then there was her attitude to the king, which meant Vashti was replaced by a young Jewish girl, Esther. Then there was the plot to assassinate the king, a plot which was discovered by a Jew. There was the edict engineered by Haman, which was aimed at exterminating the Jewish people. There was the banquet. There was Queen Esther's unusual approach to the king. There was the king's sleepless night. There was the discovery of the omission to reward Mordecai. There was the compensation to Mordecai. There was the hanging of Haman. And then there was the king's new decree. What a list of varied events. But these events all work together for good. They work together for the good of God's people and for the accomplishment of God's purpose to preserve the nation of Israel. Because God's plan for Israel had not yet been fulfilled. But let's put our finger on an important point here. In the present day, God is not dealing with an earthly nation. No. He is calling out of the nations a heavenly people. At the moment, Israel is Lo Ami. But Israel was and will always be the only earthly nation owned by God. And that brings us to the next point. God's providence among the nations of the earth. And for that we go to the book of Daniel. We all know about the prophecies of Daniel, where we're told prophetically about the existence of the four great empires, which were in fact the four Gentile empires which came to power after God removed the monarchy from Israel. And that's what the book of Daniel is all about. Nations at war with each other. God's purposes on earth being worked out. Why? So God could bring into the world his Son to establish his kingdom in Jerusalem. And what this simply means is that in spite of the turmoil among the nations of the earth, in spite of man setting up empires and forgetting God, God will not be frustrated in his purpose. You see, he foresees the state of affairs, but guards against it. Do you know that God so controls events in the international scene that the territory of every nation on earth is being adjusted and will be adjusted in accordance with his purposes for Israel? It may appear that men are bringing things about in their own strength, but in fact, everything is being overruled by God. And so in Daniel chapter 10 we read that behind the things which are seen there are unseen powers of good and powers of evil resisting one another. All being restrained or directed or controlled by God with the view of bringing about his eternal plans. You read Daniel chapter 10 and you'll see what I mean. But now finally, let's look at God's providence for the world in the death of his Son. For example, who would have thought that by means of the crucifixion, God was working out his purpose for the world? Yet so it was. You see, before even the creation of the world, God foresaw the introduction of sin into the human race. And that's why before the foundation of the world, his Son was foreordained to be the Lamb slain. And then when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth his Son to die at the hands of wicked men. But God was in control. But it was by the wickedness of men he achieved his purpose. And that's why when Peter stood up before the people on the day of Pentecost, he told them, him being delivered by the determinate counsel and foreknowledge of God, you have taken, and by wicked hands have crucified and slain. Now let's conclude. And I'll conclude by asking a question. How does the providence of God affect you and affect me in our daily life? Well, for a start, it decides many of the basic attitudes we should adopt in our Christian lives. You see, now that we know God determines our circumstances, we needn't become despondent about our circumstances. And it will assist us in our prayer life as we seek God's help and God's guidance in our lives. But somebody says that presents a problem. If God rules the hearts and actions of all men for his own purposes, if God's control is absolute, in the sense that men do only that which God has ordained, what about our own will? Does all this mean that we are no longer free agents? Of course not. The fact is that all the decisions you and I make, we are morally responsible for them. This may appear paradoxical, but nevertheless it's true. And that's why Moses said to Israel in Deuteronomy chapter 30 verse 15, see, I have set before thee this day life and good, and death and evil. Now we don't have the time to enter into the historic debate as to where God's sovereignty ends and man's free will begins. They are both truths presented in the Bible. We don't try to accommodate the one to the other. I believe we should hold both truths in their extremes. Although they're paradoxical, there's God's sovereignty and there's man's free will. Sufficient it is to say that every man and woman has a free will, and all of us are responsible for what we do. And what's more, God is going to hold us responsible. Nevertheless, there is God's providential ordering of our lives. And that's what should colour our prayer life as we approach God and we ask God to control and we ask God for things, because we know that he is over all and we are subject to his providential care.